Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got royal news, we've got Hollywood news, and for the second week in a row, we are light on politics. This is very unusual for Vanity Fair, but we will take what we're given. We're going to start in the royal section. Kate Middleton and Prince William want to start afresh in new homes, sources say. Following Queen Elizabeth's death and Princess Kate and King Charles both being diagnosed with cancer, the couple is looking forward to leaving difficult memories behind them when they move into Forest Lodge. This is by Katie Nichol on August 19th. Prince William and Kate Middleton are looking forward to starting a new chapter when they move out of Adelaide Cottage and into Forest Lodge. Sources close to the couple say they want to leave the difficult memories of the past 3 years behind and start afresh when they move into the stunning 8-bedroom, 6-bathroom home with a ballroom and a tennis court in Windsor Great Park later this year. It's the family's third move in as many years. In 2022, William, Kate, and their three children, George, Charlotte, and Louis, left London for Windsor, trading Kensington Palace for Adelaide Cottage. The 4-bedroom house is too small for the family, and friends say the couple wants a change after a turbulent 3 years. Shortly after moving into Adelaide Cottage, Queen Elizabeth died, and in 2024, Princess Kate and King Charles were both diagnosed with cancer. Sources close to the family say William and Catherine, who is in remission, are mapping out a long-term plan to stay in Windsor, where their three children are enrolled in school. Although the palace is not confirmed where Prince George will attend secondary school, William's alma mater, Eton College, is on their short list and an easy commute from Forest Lodge. Princess Charlotte and Prince Louis will stay at nearby prep school Lambrook School until they are 11. Sources have told Vanity Fair that there'll be no other changes to the couple's living arrangements and that they will keep their Kensington Palace apartment as their official London residence, as well as Amner Hall in Norfolk, which was gifted to them by the late Queen as a wedding present. William and Kate are said to be future planning for when they are King and Queen and will divide their lives between Windsor, Norfolk, and London. Apartment 1A, their grand 20-room apartment at Kensington Palace, is rarely used by the family, who do not like the fact that the residence is located in a public park. According to sources, it is unlikely that William and Kate will ever live full-time in London. Forest Lodge will be their forever home, they say, adding that they may not want to move when they become King and Queen. While Windsor Castle, the late Queen Elizabeth's favorite royal residence, would be an obvious place for the family to live when William is monarch, friends of the couple say they want a more low-key residence. It's all in keeping with William not wanting to be a drain on the public purse and living out as ordinary a life as he can, even when he is king, adds one insider. King Charles has chosen not to live at Buckingham Palace and stays at Clarence House when he is in London. He has also retained Highgrove, his Gloucester home, and spends a period of time, including the summer, at Birkhall and Balmoral. During his reign, King Charles has pledged to open more palaces to the public, including Balmoral, which opened for internal tours for the first time last summer. Our next royal headline, Prince Harry makes a discreet tribute to Prince Philip in honor of his World War II service. After King Charles and Queen Camilla left an official ceremony honoring the end of World War II, Prince Harry had a friend deliver a wreath with a heartfelt message. This is by Seraphine Roger on August 20th. On August 15th, Prince Harry honored the memory of his grandfather, Prince Philip, on the 80th anniversary of the end of the war in the Pacific during World War II. The Duke of Sussex asked a friend to lay a wreath at the foot of the National Memorial Arboretum once the official ceremony was over and King Charles III and Queen Camilla had left, so as not to disrupt the course of the day. The royal couple had been present at the commemorations and were seen to be very moved when a veteran stepped away from his speech to say a few comforting words to the sovereign, who was suffering from cancer. The wreath was accompanied by a typed letter topped by Prince Harry's seal. In it, he saluted the courage and resilience of the Forgotten Army, dedicating an entire paragraph to his grandfather, who died at the age of 99 in 2021. "For me, this anniversary carries an added layer of meaning. My late grandfather, Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, served in the Pacific Campaign, he wrote in his letter, as shared by GB News. He spoke with quiet humility about those years, but I know how deeply he was respected. He respected all who stood beside him in that theater of war. Queen Elizabeth II's husband joined the Royal Navy in 1939. After missions in the Mediterranean, he went to the Pacific. Second in command, he was on board a destroyer on a mission in Tokyo Bay when the Japanese surrendered on September 2, 1945. Today, as I think of him, I think also of each of you, of the shared hardships, the bonds forged, and the legacy you leave, confided the former soldier. He concluded, "I am humbled by your example, proud of your service and dedication, and profoundly grateful for what you endured. Your story is part of our shared heritage, and it must never be forgotten." The note was signed Prince Harry, Duke of Sussex. The 40-year-old Briton served 10 years in the armed forces, including two tours of duty in Afghanistan. Inspired by his military background, in 2014 he created the Invictus Games, a sporting event for veterans and those wounded in war. His honorary military patronages were withdrawn and returned to his grandmother, the Queen, in February 2021, 1 year after he and wife Meghan Markle relinquished their royal duties. Prince Harry has already spoken of his admiration for his grandfather, a seriously sharp wit who could hold the attention of any room due to his charm, as he wrote in a statement shared on the Archwell website after the announcement of his death. He was a consort to the monarch, a decorated serviceman, a prince and a duke, and above all, a beloved grandfather, master of the barbecue, legend of banter, and cheeky right until the end, he recalled. Now we're moving to other royals. Marius Borg Høiby, son of Crown Princess Mette Marit of Norway, indicted on 32 charges, including 4 counts of rape. The 28-year-old, whose trial could begin in January, faces up to 10 years in prison. Høiby's attorney says his client rejects the rape and domestic violence charges. This is by Antonella Rossi on August 19th. And I apologize in advance for my mispronunciation of Norwegian names. Let's continue. After an investigation, which closed in June, the Norwegian Public Prosecutor's Office officially indicted Marius Borg Høiby, the eldest son of Princess Mette Marit of Norway. The 28-year-old, the future queen consort's son with ex-partner Morten Borg, is facing an indictment for 32 offenses, including 4 for rape, 1 with sexual intercourse, and 3 without. There's an editor's note. In Norway, the crime of rape also includes incomplete sexual acts committed against a victim who is unable to resist. The maximum penalty for the crimes listed in the indictment is imprisonment for up to 10 years, said State Attorney Sturla Henriksbo in a press conference, stressing the seriousness of the situation. It is not relevant to arrest him now until new circumstances emerge that make it necessary, he continued, adding that no member of the royal family will be called to testify in the criminal case against Høiby. My assessment is that there are no members of the royal family who have been in a place or have been in contact with the accused or the injured parties in a way that makes it essential to have them as witnesses in the case, or who can shed light on the case better than we can with the evidence. However, some former guards from Skaugum Castle, the official residence of Princess Mette Marit and her husband, Crown Prince Haakon, the future king, may be questioned. Marius himself lived there until a few months ago when he reportedly moved to an outbuilding after he and some guests he hosted on the palace's cellars were accused of theft. In addition to the more serious charges, Marius Borg Høiby was also alleged to have committed lesser offenses, such as driving without a license, vandalism, and violating a restraining order. The young man's trial could begin as early as January, but he has no intention of pleading guilty to the most serious charges, according to his attorney, Peter Sikaluk. Our client denies all allegations of sexual abuse, as well as the most allegations of violence, Sekaluk said in a statement to the New York Post. He will present a detailed account of his version of events before the court. On Tuesday, Prince Haakon told reporters, "We will continue to carry out our duties as best we can, as we always do," he added. "Everyone involved in this case probably finds it challenging and difficult. The Norwegian Palace told Norwegian broadcaster NRK, it is up to the courts to hear this case and reach a decision. In November 2024, Prince Haakon told NRK that the case was solely the responsibility of the authorities. Marius is facing serious charges, which the police and the judiciary will deal with, he said. I am confident that they will do a good job. The prosecutor said that Hoiby will not be given preferential treatment. The fact that he is a member of the royal family should not, of course, mean that he should be treated more lightly or more severely than if others had committed similar acts, Henriksbo emphasized. Hoiby's case began last year when he was arrested 3 times within a few months. The charges involved assaults on women with whom he'd been in relationships. In August 2024, he was investigated after an attack on Rebecca Helberg Arnsten, his ex-girlfriend, in an Oslo apartment that he damaged. Arnsten was hospitalized for a concussion and later discharged. The second arrest came a few weeks later on charges of violating a restraining order initiated by Arnsten. The most serious charge came last November when a second investigation accused the young man of violating Article 291B of the Criminal Code, which deals with rape, specifically of sexual intercourse with persons who are unconscious or who, for other reasons, are unable to resist. And even more royals. Princess Charlene of Monaco recalls the family tragedy that led her to advocate for water safety. The princess, a former professional swimmer, has been involved with a foundation since 2014 that promotes the teaching of swimming to children and adults, which is essential in cases of difficulty in the water. This is by Antonella Rossi on August 21st. She said goodbye to competitive swimming years ago, but for Princess Charlene of Monaco, the pool is still part of her daily routine. It's thanks in part to her passion and the time she devotes to her Learn to Swim Foundation, which aims to teach the basics of swimming to children and adults in different parts of the world. A true mission, which the princess carries on in the name of her cousin Richard, who drowned when he was 5 years old. A little-known episode in the former swimmer's life, but one that affected her greatly, as she told West France in a recent interview. Richard drowned in a river very close to my uncle's house. He was only 5 years old. It was devastating for our whole family. I don't think that kind of pain ever goes away completely, the wife of Prince Albert II said. Hence, the belief that learning to swim should be a fundamental right, just like learning to read, a theme on which the princess has always insisted. Cost should never be an obstacle to acquiring life-saving skills, continued Charlene, who was reportedly greatly affected by the significant number of drowning deaths during this summer season. In France alone, according to the data reported by the Monaco Tribune, there were 193 deaths between June and July. And water safety is precisely the purpose of the Princess Charlotte of Monaco Foundation, which has been active since 2014 and features 3 programs— Learning to Swim, Water Safety, and Sports and Education. Over the years, more than 1 million people in 43 countries have taken part in the programs, large numbers to break down the limitations, often including economic ones that prevent many from accessing swimming lessons. In Monaco, Charlene knows, facilities and supervision are of high quality, while being aware that no place is totally safe and that vigilance is still necessary. Moving to American celebrities, why Diddy's legal team is still on the offensive. A swirl of celebrity-laden intrigue surrounding the hip-hop mogul culminated in his acquittal in July on the most severe charges he faced. Now Combs is apparently pushing for a pardon and suing over the most dramatic theories of his wrongdoing. This is by Dan Adler on August 22nd. Near the peak of the intrigue surrounding Sean Diddy Combs last year, a purported memoir by Kim Porter, the late mother of his 4 of his children, rose to the top of the Amazon bestseller list. Kim's Lost Words recounted a supposed array of startling sexual adventures and violence, and ended with Porter seeming to predict her own murder at her partner's hands. It was independently published by Chris Todd, a little-known but enthusiastic peddler of celebrity conspiracy. Amazon quickly pulled the book, which a friend of Porter's described to me at the time as all lies. In the lead-up to his trial this spring on sex trafficking and racketeering charges, Combs was primarily fighting his criminal case, but his lawyers also began combating the cottage industry of media projects that had sprung out of the allegations against him. Following his acquittal on the most severe counts he faced, he was convicted on two prostitution charges and remains in jail ahead of his sentencing in October. He has ratcheted up that offensive. Combs last week amended a defamation complaint he had filed in January to seek at least $100 million in damages from Todd affiliate Courtney Burgess, an itinerant social media player who advertises ties to the music industry, as well as Burgess's attorney and the parent company of the news outlet that aired Burgess's claims. According to Combs' suit, Burgess, lawyer Ariel Mitchell, and Nexstar's Media News Nation undertook a scheme to broadcast lies about the mogul. Mitchell said in an interview with the outlet in September that there already have been tapes leaking around Hollywood being shopped around to individuals in Hollywood, and the host replied, "It sounds like there was probably a lot of hidden cameras as well." Burgess's claim that Porter provided him with a draft of her memoir, as well as videos depicting Combs sexually assaulting inebriated celebrities and minors, and he has said that he was the source of the memoir edited and published by Todd. "Todd previously told me, I stand by this book 100%. When reached now for comment on the book's removal from Amazon, he suggested I interview Burgess. Mitchell didn't return a request for comment on her or Burgess's behalf. Her attorney recently moved to dismiss the suit against her. Nexstar declined to comment." Anybody who read about the trial as it was going on, Combs' attorney, Tenny Garagos, said in an interview this week, will know by now that none of what was publicly alleged or part of these conspiracy theories prior to the trial are true. Garagos said that Combs' efforts to push back on the prevailing social media chatter should be considered separate from his criminal fight, an attempt to protect his legacy and family. After the sentencing, she said, "We will continue to focus on clearing out all the misinformation that was spread about him." Combs has also sued NBC Universal and Peacock over their documentary, Diddy, The Making of a Bad Boy, in which the R&B singer Al B. Sure claims that Porter, with whom he had a child, was murdered. The Los Angeles coroner's office said in early 2019 that Porter's death resulted from lobar pneumonia. A representative for Peacock didn't return a request for comment, but their company has moved to dismiss the suit. Simultaneously, an effort to secure a pardon for Combs is apparently underway. Another of his attorneys, Nicole Westmoreland, recently told CNN, "It is my understanding that we've reached out and had conversations in reference to a pardon." Donald Trump, a regular companion of Combs in the New York 90s, has seemed to enjoy toying with the idea, telling Newsmax, "I was very friendly with him. I got along with him great and he seemed like a nice guy." Still, Trump added, "When I ran for office, he was very hostile," noting how he would make pardoning Combs more difficult to do. Garagos declined to comment on any effort to secure a pardon. For his part, Mark Agnifilo, Combs' lead attorney, said in an interview with CBS News that he has nothing to do with a possible pardon and has had conversations with nobody. To a large degree, Burgess's and Mitchell's claims reflected the overall tenor of the discussion around Combs since he was first accused of sexual and physical abuse by his ex-girlfriend, Cassandra Cassie Ventura, in November 2023. Combs and Ventura quickly settled Ventura's lawsuit. Combs denied any wrongdoing and connected to Ventura's claims, but apologized after videos surfaced of him beating her in the hallway of a hotel. Combs' decades of fame and his bountiful photographs with other celebrities make him a natural subject for the legions of streamers, podcasters, and social media personalities who have proliferated in recent years. The terms Diddy parties and freak-offs became a catch-all slang for sexual deviance. When the verdict in Combs' trial arrived last month, the YouTuber Armin Wiggins poured baby oil on himself amid the celebrations, a reference to the product frequently invoked by prosecutors for having been stalked by Combs. Wiggins soon issued an Instagram apology for the stunt. "I've been involved in a lot of media trials in my career," Garagos said, "but I had never seen anything quite like this. Ahead of the trial, she worried how the dynamic might play out in the courtroom. "The emails and calls I was getting were frankly very scary," she said. I asked Garagos, given the sea of content created around her client's case, how Combs' legal team was picking its battles. "This one felt like the particular juncture where we could and should," she said, "because they tried to use the criminal process in making false claims." Burgess testified before a federal grand jury in October and spoke to TMZ and other news outlets outside the courthouse afterward. Garagos had also combated the narrative around Combs by making TikTok videos, though she said that media savvy did not come natural to her, or at least not as naturally as it has to her father, the prominent defense attorney Mark Garagos, who co-hosts a podcast with TMZ founder Harvey Levin. Mark Garagos has made appearances at Combs' court proceedings, and after he described the prosecution as a six-pack of white women on his show, the judge told him that his remark would not be tolerated in any court from any lawyer anywhere across the nation. Celebrity conspiracies aside, the testimony during Combs' trial made for jarring viewing. Ventura recounted in painstaking detail the abuse she said she suffered at the hands of Combs. In a recent interview with podcaster Alex Cooper, the rapper Kid Cudi, who dated Ventura during a period when she was on and off with Combs, recalled his own experience testifying. There was no doubt an element of frisson for Cooper's viewers in this mix of personalities, though it was sharply undercut when Cudi told Cooper how he interpreted Ventura's experience. "I've always just wanted to see her thrive and do well and be happy," he said, "because I know she was living a nightmare." We're moving to the Hollywood section. Our first headline, Shoshana Stern broke barriers as a deaf actor. Then Marlee Matten asked her to direct. Stern starred in Weeds, Supernatural, and Grey's Anatomy, but has just proven herself as a major filmmaker. Matlin says she's made history as a director who happens to be deaf, to portray the film the way that deaf people should be portrayed. This is by David Canfield on August 20th. Deep into an evening spent on the set of the Sundance series This Close, Shoshana Stern and Marlee Matten started chatting while waiting to resume filming on a long dinner scene. The pair had already bonded as deaf actors. Stern, who also served as the show's co-creator and executive producer, had found great inspiration in her Oscar-winning co-star. She can't recall what they were talking about exactly, but at a certain point, she noticed Matlin staring at her. "She's looking at me and she says, 'You need to direct,'" Stern says. What was going on in Matlin's head at the moment? "It was late at night, and I kept thinking as I was watching her that she's been around this industry for a while, and it just popped into my head," she says. "She doesn't give up easily when it comes to writing. She doesn't give up easily when it comes to acting. She sets her mind to it, so why not go beyond that and go up beyond to direct?" Around this time, producers had approached Matlin, interested in making a documentary about her life. She stipulated that she would participate only if Stern, who, again, had never directed before, helmed the film. Years later, Stern's Marlee Matten, Not Alone Anymore, is critically acclaimed, award-winning, and now playing in select theaters. It's also available for digital rental or purchase. The film offers a nuanced portrait of a Hollywood icon through Stern's bold use of craft and narrative. Still, that night on This Close set, Stern didn't feel remotely ready to take on such a project. She had built her own acting career playing roles on major series such as Weeds and Grey's Anatomy before finding her voice as a screenwriter. "I literally had never thought about directing before," Stern says, speaking in American Sign Language beside an interpreter. "I didn't think I could. I didn't think I would be allowed to." When I later relay this to Matlin over Zoom, her face falls. "I'm basically experiencing PTSD as a result of those words being used. A lot of kids who are deaf experience those same words," Matlin says. "I'm glad that she was able to change her mind about feeling not allowed to say, 'Fuck off, fuck off.'" Stern grew up in the Bay Area to a fourth-generation deaf family. Her mother was a stage actor. As a kid, she wanted to follow in those footsteps. This was before the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, though. There were almost no captions on TV, so you're hungry for information. You're hungry for stories. That makes you very curious, Stern says. I'm always asking my friends who can hear, what's the other table talking about? They're usually like, I don't know, I'm not listening. I would never stop listening if I could. We're pretty much by ourselves on this warm July day, however, sitting in a quiet vegan restaurant near her Los Angeles home. After she orders her lunch, Stern tells me about the challenges she faced in chasing her dreams. While she planned to study theater at college, her education was supported by the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, which helps many deaf people in the transition out of high school. It requires program approval for any major. You don't really have freedom. They said, no, theater is not a reasonable major to have. You're not going to be a contributing member of society if you major in theater, Stern says. She chose English while still acting in plays at Gallaudet University whenever she could. During the winter break before her final semester, she went home and told her parents she was going to quit acting for good. The next day, she got an email from Warner Brothers with an audition offer. The secretary for Gallaudet's theater department had recommended Stern to the casting agents of the sitcom Off Center, created by the Weitz brothers of American Pie fame. She gave them my email address. I didn't have an agent. I didn't have anything. I was a college student, Stern says. She booked the cheapest flight she could down to L.A. and completed the audition. Then she booked the part and has essentially been in Hollywood ever since. Even when auditioning for deaf parts throughout the aughts, Stern was often the only deaf actor in the room. This was decades out from Children of a Lesser God, Rhonda Haynes' searing 1986 take on the romantic drama that made Matlin the first ever deaf actor to win an Oscar. Troy Kotsur became the second for Coda, which also starred Matlin, in 2022. Stern bristles when hearing that movie called groundbreaking, to say nothing of her other milestones achieved by her and her peers before and since. Stories about deaf people can be groundbreaking. They can, Stern says. But I would like to think that it's because they push perspective. They push the form. They push understanding. They push the nuance. Stern fits that bill. In conversations, she's playful, witty, and as advertised, deeply curious. A decent chunk of our interview gets flipped on me as she warmly grills me about my own career. She's also reluctant to dig into the worst encounters she's had in Hollywood or to give herself too much credit for her big breaks. But the fact remains, she made major industry strides. She's observing everything and finding little, casual, easy ways to contribute and support, says Jesse Williams, who directed and co-starred with Stern on Grey's Anatomy. She anticipates things you might be wondering about or need you might have and just breaks the ice. In Weeds, Stern gave a bracing performance as an overachieving teen thrust into a pregnancy scandal. The role was expanded in part on the advocacy of star Mary Louise Parker, who encouraged Stern's particular acting choices. Stern's audition for a non-deaf character on the CBS drama Jericho, meanwhile, led to the producers creating a lead character for her, which then brought her into the writer's room to help shape the storyline. There was one script I got that was really hard because all I saw was their own perception about what they felt like my experience, my life was like, Stern says. Executive producer Carol Barbie gave me a paper and a pen and she said, here, write what you would say. I crossed out what I was supposed to say in the script and wrote in pencil what I wanted to say and she's like, oh, okay, we're shooting this. Stern got excited after Jericho. She nabbed a juicy part in the big network series. She'd established herself on other hits. I'm like, oh my God, this is going to keep happening. I'll just keep going and reading for roles that are not for deaf people, and then they're going to cast me, Stern says. And that never happened again. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith, and I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article about Shoshana Stern, a deaf actor and now director. It's a lesson learned by many deaf actors for as long as Stern has been in the industry. The increased amount of opportunities that there are for each individual deaf actor out there now, it leads to the perception that there are more deaf actors that are working, and there really aren't, Stern says. Even for Marley, she hasn't worked since Coda. The media still keeps asking her, like, isn't it great to be a deaf actor today? For her, no, it isn't. It kind of hasn't, but she's been put in a position to speak for all of us. She has to say, yeah, it's great. The period since Coda, which starred a largely deaf cast and won the Best Picture Oscar, is more broadly instructive, Stern says. There were so many projects in development as a result of Coda, which was great, but none of them ended up going forward. Stern continued to take small recurring jobs on shows like Supernatural and Lie to Me, while cultivating an entirely new path for herself. She became a professor, teaching deaf studies for 7 years. She worked on the creative team for Deaf West Theater's Spring Awakening revival that made it to Broadway and received major Tony nominations. She started writing for TV, including on Marvel's Echo, and most significantly, co-created This Close, a terrific indie series that also happened to showcase Stern's richest screen role to date. In its review, The Hollywood Reporter called the series a worthy reminder that Stern probably would have been a star long ago if Hollywood were more creative when it comes to utilizing deaf actors. Even on that show, the directors, including The Wedding Banquet's Andrew Ahn, and crew were not deaf. But it's one reason why, when Matlin brought directing up to Stern out of nowhere, the notion was hard to fathom. My first thought was so stupid, it was like, but wait, directors communicate through comms, through headsets. Why did I think that? Stern says. The form of documentaries itself, I didn't consider. I just accepted it the way it was. The way they cut away from people's faces, but you still hear their voices. And then you have to go back to their faces. You don't think about things until you have to. So when Stern got the gig, there was only one way to make a movie about Marlee Matlin. Blow the form wide open. John Schenck is an Oscar-nominated director, producer, and cinematographer known for helming major docs over decades alongside his partner Bonnie Cohen, such as An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. Their company backed Marlee Matlin, Not Alone Anymore, and he also served as director of photography. He was amazed by the way Stern, a first-time filmmaker, made him rethink his entire craft. We're going to have to develop a way of shooting that was certainly new to us and may now make a contribution to how films about people who sign instead of speak English are made, he said. And that was a cool opportunity as a filmmaker in my mid-50s now to be forced to rethink literally how we film. Schenck and Stern mounted an original multi-camera style wherein observational scenes, tracking Matlin in private and public moments alike, would ensure that the hands and upper body were always visible, so that any signing could be always communicated in the frame. Interviews were set up so as to seamlessly depict, in split screen, fluid conversations in ASL between Stern and Matlin, or whoever else was featured. Then there's the sound design, which brings viewers directly into Matlin's audiovisual world. It's not silent, as someone unfamiliar with a deaf person's experience might assume, but authentically complex. These elements together create a personal intimacy that's all too rare in the celeb doc landscape, with Stern's particular artistry informing her reframing of Matlin's legacy, down to the color-coded closed captioning. The film has a special quality when you're watching it, that you've entered a different world as a hearing person, and it's incredibly privileged and special once you kind of sink into it, Schenck says. Shoshana was really driven to make the language itself at the forefront of the film. She reminded us that pretty much every time we went out to shoot, every time we talked about the story of film. Matlin adds, I really, finally saw a movie that made sense to me. I didn't feel excluded. I didn't feel like this was made by a hearing person who was looking for a way to tell my story. She's made history as a director who happens to be deaf, to portray in film the way that deaf people should be portrayed. Stern looks back on the way she made the movie, which earned raves out of its Sundance premiere and is now set for an Oscar campaign this fall, as an affirmation of her instincts. Growing up, there were always people who believed that I couldn't do something, she says. Only certain people are allowed to be nervous. I knew there were a lot of people that thought, wow, this is her first time. And if I showed my nervousness, that would be fuel for them to think, oh no, she can't do this. We made a mistake. I usually get nervous after it's over, Stern says later. So is she nervous now? It's not over, she says quickly. Indeed, it feels like a new beginning. Next up, an exclusive first look. Bradley Cooper and Will Arnett storm the stand-up stage in Is This Thing On? Arnett did weeks of comedy shows in character to play a man facing a divorce and finding new purpose during a midlife catharsis in the Cooper-helmed comedic drama. This is by Rebecca Ford on August 21st. The first time Will Arnett met Bradley Cooper was for an audition, of sorts. At the time, Arnett was dating Amy Poehler, who had become good friends with Cooper during filming on their 2001 movie, Wet Hot American Summer. Poehler wanted to see what Cooper thought of Arnett, so they all met up at a bar in New York, joined by fellow Poehler pal Janine Garofalo. "Amy sort of paraded me in front of two of her friends to see if I was okay," says Arnett. "They didn't grill me, but it was a lot of like, all right, who's this guy?" Arnett would pass the test. He and Poehler married and were together for 9 years, and he and Cooper would become good friends, later living next door to each other in Venice, California. "We lived two doors down from Dennis Hopper, and we used to always be like, man, Dennis Hopper lives right here," says Arnett. It blew our minds. Cooper also credits Arnett with helping him get on the path towards sobriety during that time. Both men would go on to have busy careers, with Arnett starring in shows like Arrested Development, 30 Rock, and Flaked. Cooper starred in films such as those in the Hangover franchise, American Hustle, and American Sniper, before pursuing his directorial career with A Star Is Born and Maestro. They would often talk about working together, but the right thing never came along. That changed with a script about a fledgling stand-up comic in crisis, the film Is This Thing On?, which will have its world premiere at the New York Film Festival on October 10th, before being released in select theaters by Searchlight on December 19th, feels to them like the culmination of a 25-year friendship, full of personal touches from their own histories. It also allows Arnett and Cooper to show different sides of their abilities. The comedic drama follows a middle-aged man, Alex, played by Arnett, who's on the verge of a divorce and seeking new purpose in the New York comedy scene. At the same time, his wife, Tess, played by Laura Dern, is confronting her own history as the two are forced to navigate co-parenting and identity. The film aims to pull audiences into the subculture of the New York comedy scene. "This movie is not a midlife crisis. It's a midlife catharsis," says Cooper in his first interview about the film. "Sometimes you realize you're coasting and you've lost your rudder and your North Star in life, and that takes a toll on whoever's in your orbit." Arnett met British comedian John Bishop at a social event several years ago and was struck by his story of how he stumbled into stand-up comedy when his marriage fell apart. He convinced Bishop to let him and writing partner Mark Chappell take a stab at a film inspired by his story. Arnett brought an early draft of the script to Cooper while he was in production on Maestro, and Cooper signed on to co-write and direct it. "I think that's something interesting that I wanted to explore, with that this guy's able to be honest with a room full of strangers in a way that he wasn't able to be before," says Cooper, who is also as a supporting role as Alex's close friend. They decided they would open on the day when Tess tells Alex that she wants a divorce, rather than chronicling all the messy lead-up to that moment. "You don't really know anything other than they just decided to break up," says Cooper, "but there's no cataclysmic thing. It's through Alex's process and the progression of his burgeoning stand-up career that you learn more about who he is, while also witnessing his metamorphosis. The effect that it has on his life is so huge," says Arnett, "because it allows him to talk in a way that he's never talked before, and to be open and vulnerable." Cooper's first two feature directorial efforts, A Star Is Born and Maestro, both center on entertainers, as does Is This Thing On? But what's more of a through line in his Oscar-nominated work as a director is the authenticity with which he makes his movies. For A Star Is Born, he and Lady Gaga sang live in front of a real audience of thousands. For Maestro, Cooper spent 6 years learning to conduct an orchestra. Before shooting Is This Thing On?, Arnett performed shows in character as Alex 4 to 5 times a week for 6 straight weeks. Despite his comedic success on screen, Arnett had never before performed stand-up. There were times it went really well and times it didn't, sometimes even on the same night. "At the Comedy Cellar one night, he absolutely crushed it," says Cooper. "We were talking about how maybe after the movie, I've got to direct his Netflix special at Madison Square Garden." And then they walked to another club to do the same set where he absolutely bombed. "Not only is nobody laughing, but people have a look of disdain on their face and there's nowhere for me to hide," says Arnett. "You can't even imagine how vulnerable you feel in that moment." But it was perfect for the character. This is not a story about the next Michael Jordan of stand-up stumbling into a comedy club and having meteoric rise to stardom. It's about a regular guy who uses stand-up to figure himself out. Will's the funniest guy you'll ever meet in a room, says Cooper. And for him to play a guy who's not really good at stand-up and just sort of working his way, that was incredible to behold. Cooper and cinematographer Matthew Libatique, his frequent collaborator, wanted audience members to feel like they were active participants in Alex's world. They used handheld cameras and Cooper pick locations in New York, attempting to capture the feeling he had when he first came to the city for graduate school. Cooper also took on a new role for the film, camera operator. It allowed him to get even closer to the actors to create the intimacy he hoped to capture in the film. It's incredibly rare when your director knows exactly what he wants and needs, and he's literally able to whisper in your ear while shooting at you, says Dern. It's like the three of us have shared lifetime memories of either laughing hysterically in the middle of a take or being in tears at the end of it because something happened that we didn't expect and it felt human and beautiful. Cooper's been friends with Dern for more than a decade and thought of the role of Tess would feel like a new challenge for the Oscar-winning actor. I wanted to write something that merited her worth, he says. Also, I wanted to do something that would push her, or maybe that she hadn't done before. Dern calls the role radically different from the types of characters she's known for portraying. I have played very emotional people in my life, very deeply empathetic, emotional characters, and crazy addictive characters, and angry characters, but always emotion is at the forefront. But Tess, a former Olympic-level volleyball player, is stoic and determined. To understand her point of view, Dern spent time with former professional athletes, including her friend Gabrielle Reese, who talked to her about what it's like for an athlete when their career ends. That was really interesting, but far more still character for me. Dern's experience shooting the movie reminded her of her early days in indie filmmaking, and though she's visited Cooper in editing bays and talked to him about film for years, this was her first time seeing him in a new light as her director. He just takes the wildest swings, and he tries everybody's note, but he sticks to his vision and gives himself the freedom to find it, she says. Filming concluded only 4 months ago, and Cooper's been rushing to wrap up editing in time to make the New York Film Festival's closing night. Arnett hasn't done stand-up since filming wrapped, but when Cooper and Arnett were recently viewing a cut of the film in New York, Cooper turned to Arnett and asked if he wanted to go over to the Cellar to perform a set. For a minute, Arnett thought he'd do it. There was an addictive quality to it, says Arnett. That's how good it feels. This next article is going to segue into the short politics section today. Our headline is Arnold Schwarzenegger is ready to take on Gavin Newsom. The Terminator star prepares to battle his gubernatorial successor over California's redistricting plans. This is by Eve Beatty on August 17th. In these divided times, Californians of both stripes have been comforted by how readily its most recent Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and current Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom have come together, especially when it came to standing up to Republicans, as if you didn't know, President Donald Trump. But that Golden State Alliance ended this week after Newsom announced a plan to redistrict California in response to a Trump-inspired gerrymandering scheme in Texas. For months now, Trump's team has been lobbying GOP lawmakers and governors to redraw state maps to ensure a Republican House majority in the 2026 midterm elections. In Indiana, for example, Trump asked Governor Mike Braun to call for a special legislative session to redistrict the Hoosier state, even sending Vice President J.D. Vance to implore leaders to convene. Braun, who Trump relegated to the kids' table during his star-studded inauguration, has yet to make a decision on the matter, but his counterpart in Texas, Greg Abbott, is all in on the plan, with a special redistricting session planned for this week that could net the GOP 5 more House seats. In response, Newsom announced his own redistricting proposal Thursday, saying via X that he will call a special election to redraw our congressional maps and defend fair representation. At a press conference on Thursday to promote the November 4th vote, Newsom explained that redrawing California's electoral map would generate 5 Democratic House seats, effectively negating any Texas gains. It's a move that the state must make in reaction to a president of the United States that called a sitting governor of the state of Texas and said, "Find me 5 seats," Newsom said. "I know they say don't mess with Texas. Well, don't mess with the Golden State," Newsom said, even as Trump appeared to do just that. Armed and masked ICE agents assembled just outside Newsom's press event to promote the redistricting effort, a show of force that LA Mayor Karen Bass described as completely unacceptable, and Newsom pointed to as proof that California's redistricting is the only way forward. The ICE agent's presence was, quote, "pretty sick and pathetic," Newsom told reporters, describing it as everything one needs to know about Donald Trump's America. That scene must have sent chills down the spine of Newsom's fellow Californian, Arnold Schwarzenegger. The Terminator star, who had Newsom's current job from November 17, 2003 to January 3, 2011, was born shortly after World War II to a member of the Nazi Party, a group that under Trump has experienced a significant revival. "My father was, and so many other millions of men were, sucked into a hate system through lies and deceit, and so we have seen where that leads," Schwarzenegger said in a 2023 interview. The former governor was so disgusted by Trump that he endorsed Kamala Harris for president in 2024, saying the convicted felon will divide, he will insult, he will find new ways to be more un-American than he already has been, and we, the people, will get nothing but more anger. But in a somewhat cryptic Instagram post on Friday, Schwarzenegger suggested his willingness to oppose Trump only goes so far. In a photo taken at the gym, the former governor is seated at what appears to be an isolateral front lat pull-down machine, wearing a t-shirt that reads, "Fuck the politicians. Terminate gerrymandering." Schwarzenegger's chief of staff, Daniel Ketchel, tells Vanity Fair that the post was intended to communicate his distaste for any effort to redistrict, regardless of motive. Governor Schwarzenegger has a 20-year history of battling gerrymandering, taking power from the politicians and returning it to the people where it belongs. And he believes gerrymandering is evil, no matter who does it, Ketchel said via email. He still stands by the rule we learn in preschool: 2 wrongs don't make a right. He will continue to be on the side of the people and not politicians from either party on this issue. It's a stance that Newsom's camp finds deeply disappointing. "We agree with the former governor on the urgent need for national independent redistricting," Courtney Pugh, an advisor to the California Redistricting Campaign, tells Vanity Fair via written statement, "but we fundamentally disagree on this moment of crisis. Trump and his Texas cronies are trying to rig the 2026 election before a single person is voted," Pugh continued. "This is a 5-alarm fire for our democracy." It's unclear how hard Schwarzenegger will fight Newsom or what form that opposition will take. Speaking with the New York Times, Schwarzenegger said that he won't be aligning himself with the GOP as he moves forward against the current governor's plans. "He was kind enough to let me know what he's up to and how he feels," the FUBAR star says of Newsom. "I told him, I totally get it. I understand it. I said, there's no effect on our relationship." But on this one issue, Schwarzenegger says he must stand up to both his party and his state's leader. "I hate the idea of the Republicans redrawing the district lines in Texas as much as I hate what the Californians are trying to do," he says. "But I'm thinking now about California and about the people of California. I promised them that we're going to create a commission that would be independent of the politicians, and there will be independent citizens commission drawing the lines. So I'm not going to go back on my promise. I'm going to fight for my promise." Our next headline is entitled "Looming Influence: Trump Admin Halts Visas for Wounded Gazans After Laura Loomer Complains." This isn't the first time the far-right anti-Muslim commentator had a direct line to the White House. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on August 17th. The State Department announced on Saturday morning that it was halting all visitor visas to people coming in from Gaza to conduct a full and thorough review of the process and procedures, which were being used to issue a small number of visas to those seeking medical care, according to a post on X from the federal agency. The move comes less than 17 hours after Laura Loomer, a far-right, anti-Muslim commentator close to President Donald Trump, who has said she's pro-white nationalism, complained online about Palestinians seeking medical care after being wounded by Israel's continued offensive in the region. How is allowing for Islamic immigrants to come to the U.S. America First policy, she asked on X. The Jew-hating Gaza First idiots pretend to be America first, but they are America last. They want the U.S. to be flooded with Muslims pretending to be refugees so they can cancel out our votes, she continued, adding, I don't care if they're kids. The U.S. is full. Since Friday, Loomer has gone on a posting spree claiming, without evidence, that an Islamist in the State Department is supporting terrorism or fast-tracking visas for Islamists. After the department announced that they were halting visas to those fleeing violence in Gaza, Loomer was quick to thank Secretary Marco Rubio and take credit for his agency's decision, writing that she saved so many American citizens from being killed by pro-Hamas jihadis. According to an analysis by NBC News of monthly figures provided on the State Department's website, the United States has issued more than 3,800 B1 and B2 visitor visas, which permit foreigners to seek medical treatment in the United States, to holders of the Palestinian Authority travel document so far in 2025. In May, 640 visas were issued. The department's numbers do not clarify how many of those visas were given to Gazans and how many people were from the West Bank in Palestine. The Palestinian people coming into the U.S. to seek medical care are fleeing a worsening situation in Gaza and the West Bank, one funded by American tax dollars and supported by the Trump administration. The president has repeatedly talked about taking over the Gaza Strip, potentially by force, and turning it into the Riviera of the Middle East. I think the potential in the Gaza Strip is unbelievable, Trump said in a February press conference following a White House meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We have an opportunity to do something that could be phenomenal, he continued, adding, we'll do a job with it too. We'll own it. Currently, 86% of the Gaza Strip is a no-go area, or Israel-ordered displacement zone, per Al Jazeera, after Israel's security cabinet approved a plan by Netanyahu for the military occupation of Gaza City in early August. According to a tracker from Al Jazeera based on figures from the Palestinian Ministry of Health, Israel's military action has killed at least 61,944 people, including at least 18,430 children. More than 155,885 people have been wounded due to Israel's offensive. The deaths from starvation are rising following Israel's March blockade of food and humanitarian aid and the military's ongoing control of what supplies are allowed into Palestine. Per polling from Gallup, Americans' approval of Israel's military action in Gaza is the lowest it's been in the analytics since the analytics company first asked the questions in November 2023, 1 month after the October 7th Hamas attacks that killed more than 1,200 people. Disapproval by Americans of the military action by Israeli forces in Palestine has now reached 60%. As has been the case since the start of the conflict, the Gallup report reads, Independents, 25%, express higher approval than Democrats at 8%, but both groups currently register their lowest readings to date. In contrast, 71% of Republicans say they approve of Israel's action in Gaza, up from 66% in September. The disapproval was felt in New York City on Saturday as thousands joined a Stop Starving Gaza protest and march. More than 200 organizations took part in the event, per CBS. Mahmoud Khalil, the Palestinian activist who was held by the Trump administration in an ICE detention facility for 104 days, kicked off the rally. In what world is the starvation of an entire population of people normal, Khalil said, going on to quote Al Jazeera journalist Anis al-Sharif, who was killed last week in a deliberate Israeli attack on a media tent. Following the State Department's move to halt visas on Saturday, aid groups quickly urged the U.S. to reverse its decision. This will have a devastating and irreversible impact on our ability to bring injured and critically ill children from Gaza to the U.S. for life-saving medical treatment, the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund said. This is extremely devastating news, Tariq Hilat, the director of Global Patient Affairs at the PCRF, told Al Jazeera. The impact of this decision will be devastating, and the U.S. must honestly reverse this decision immediately. Heal Palestine, a group that coordinates evacuations for injured children and their families to the U.S., says it has assisted 148 people so far, among them 63 children in need of urgent care. They were distressed by the State Department's decision. In a statement, they contradicted the implication that Palestinians seeking medical care were part of a larger resettlement program, writing that after the temporary visa holders received medical care, not available at home, they returned to the Middle East. Loomer's recent reported influence on the State Department isn't the first time she's had a direct line to President Trump and his administration. In April, Trump fired six national security aides after Loomer expressed dissatisfaction with some members of the team in a meeting with the president. In July, April Falcone Doss, a lawyer for the National Security Agency, was removed from her position after Loomer amplified criticism of her, according to the New York Times. Other government officials have reportedly been ousted or stepped down following Loomer's attacks on them. It's amazing how fast we can get results from the Trump administration, Loomer wrote Saturday morning on X, followed by the clapping emoji. We're going to end with a conversation about Elliot Spitzer finally speaking out on the NYC mayor's race. This is by Chris Smith on August 18th. Elliot Spitzer had politely declined all spring when other reporters called wanting him to weigh in on the New York City mayoral race, especially because his longtime antagonist, Andrew Cuomo, seemed headed for an improbable comeback win. The ex-governor said no. When Vanity Fair called last week, though, Spitzer talked. Spitzer, 66, has largely retreated from public political life. In 2008, he resigned in the midst of a prostitution scandal from the state's top job. Spitzer re-emerged to host a CNN show, and he made a losing run for city comptroller in 2013. Since then, however, he spent most of his time running Spitzer Enterprises, the real estate development company founded by his father Bernard in 1952. Spitzer's crossed paths with Donald Trump for decades, and he was once the hottest establishment-rattling thing in Democratic politics, a status now enjoyed by mayoral frontrunner Zohran Mamdani. Also like Mamdani, Spitzer has clashed with Cuomo, who, like Spitzer, resigned in disgrace as New York's governor, all of which gives him expertise on the current moment. I don't know about expert, Spitzer says with a laugh, but I do have opinions, including that Mamdani has correctly identified affordability as the greatest threat to the city's future. But his answer may make the problem even worse, and that Trump's tariff drama can be explained as the myopic behavior of somebody who enjoys being at the center of attention. Spitzer spoke to Vanity Fair from his Manhattan office during a break in closing a property transaction. Vanity Fair says, "You're finishing a deal. Is this a good time to be in the New York real estate business?" Elliot Spitzer says, "Real estate is doing fine. The demand at the high end is real. Our structure of rent laws has unfortunately inhibited the creation of the supply that we need to keep the city viable. What we need to do is a very significant upzoning that would permit more housing in areas where transportation permits people to get access to the job centers." If your taxes go up as a result of his proposals, are you going to leave town? No, a 2% shift shouldn't make people leave. On the other hand, there is data that a significant number of wealthy taxpayers have left. And it's also a reality that a very significant piece of the tax receipts of the city come from that upper strata. You've also interacted with Trump many times over the years. What's your favorite story? None of them is a favorite. Trump used to come over to my dad's office and talk about real estate. My dad, who began without anything, he didn't have two nickels to rub together, did quite well, and did it by dint of hard work and intelligence. One time, Trump left my dad's office and my dad said, "He has not read a book in 30 years," which was fine and kind of irrelevant as long as Trump was just a real estate developer, right? But when he's a president of the United States, the lack of understanding of either history or society or broader social issues is problematic. This is all the time we have here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Thank you all, and have a great week, everybody.